You are tuned into KBOO Portland. The time is 5:59 and 23 seconds right there on the dot. Coming up next is Bread and Roses, but first, KBOO's got some stuff to tell you.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 29th annual Cascade Festival of African Films, happening Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, now through Saturday, March 2nd. Most films will show at the Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building, room 104 at PCC Cascade Campus, 705 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. Again, that's the 29th annual Cascade Festival of African Films, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, now through Saturday, March 2nd. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
At the dawn of the day, all the darkened kitchens, the mill of gray, all touched by the radiance.
Good evening, KBOO. Hello, you are tuning in to 90.7 FM. This is Evergreen for Bread and Roses, and I'm your host, Rachel Hartley. Again, this is Evergreen for Bread and Roses. Not with, but for Bread and Roses. And I say for because that's my way of honoring all of the women before me who spoke at this mic or any mic in this station to give you their intake or their opinion when it comes to feminism and shutting down the patriarchy. So for this evening, I definitely want to discuss anger and what it means for Black women. And if this is your first time tuning in to Evergreen for Bread and Roses, me as your host, Rachel Hartley, I identify as a Black woman. And so all of the things that I say will be pertaining to my identity as a Black woman. I'm also a queer woman. So I speak on my identity being Black and being bi and being identifying as a cisgender woman. And I hope that we learn things today, as every Friday, as I try to do, you know, and throughout the process, I say things in correlation to Black feminism, but I learn every show as well. So yes, thank you so much for tuning in. So this evening, I want everyone to think about what it means to be angry. What does anger feel like? What does anger entail? You know, when's the last time you were angry with someone, something, anything? I think that it what it means is that if we can talk about what Oh my goodness. All right. Hi. All right. All right. Hello, everyone. Okay. So this I just want to say hi, Janka Soderbergh. And I want everybody to know that Janka Soderbergh is with the business. And I'm just floored right now. She just handed me a sheet of paper that states that she found audio of Asada Shakur speaking, and I really want to play it. And thank you for asking me to play it. I want to play it because if you were also tuning into the community report and the news, we've been talking about Asada because it's the day of Asada, according to The Root, which is a Black national news outlet. And so this is a statement recorded by Asada Shakur in her own words. This was recorded 3 years ago when the U.S. government again placed her on the most wanted list. And as I said before, yo, she's enemy number one. And increased the reward for her capture from $1 million to $2 million. This is Asada.
Panther Party, an organization that was targeted by, not hesitated to publicize their request. I am completely uninformed as to the accusations they are making against me. Why, I wonder, do I warrant such attention? What do I represent that is such a threat? Please let me take a moment to tell you about myself. My name is Asada Shakur, and I was born and raised in the United States. I am a descendant of Africans who were kidnapped and brought to the Americas as slaves. I spent my early childhood in the racist, segregated South. I later moved to the northern part of the country, where I realized that Black people were equally victimized by racism and oppression. I grew up and became a political activist, participating in student struggles, the anti-war movement, and most of all, in the movement for the liberation of African Americans in the United States. I later joined the Black Panther Party, an organization that was targeted by the COINTELPRO program, a program that was set up by the Federal Bureau of Investigation to eliminate all political opposition to the U.S. government's policies, to destroy the Black liberation movement in the United States, to discredit activists, and to eliminate potential leaders. Under the COINTELPRO program, many political activists were harassed, imprisoned, murdered, or otherwise neutralized. As a result of being targeted by COINTELPRO, I, like many other young people, was faced with the threat of prison, underground, exile, or death. The FBI, with the help of local police agencies, systematically fed false accusations and fake news articles to the press, accusing me and other activists of crimes we did not commit. Although in my case the charges were eventually dropped or I was eventually acquitted, the national and local police agencies created a situation where, based on their false accusations against me, any police officer could shoot me on sight. It was not until the Freedom of Information Act was passed in the mid-70s that we began to see the scope of the United States government's persecution of political activists. At this point, I think that it is important to make one thing very clear. I have advocated, and I still advocate, revolutionary changes in the structure and in the principles that govern the United States. I advocate self-determination for my people and for all oppressed people inside the United States. I advocate an end to capitalist exploitation, the abolition of racist policies, the eradication of sexism, and the elimination of political repression. If that is a crime, then I am totally guilty. To make a long story short, I was captured in New Jersey in 1973 after being shot with both arms held in the air and then shot again from the back. I was left on the ground to die, and when I did not, I was taken to a local hospital where I was threatened, beaten, and tortured. In 1977, I was convicted in a trial that can only be described as a legal lynching. In 1979, I was able to escape with the aid of some of my fellow comrades. I saw this as a necessary step, not only because I was innocent of the charges against me, but because I knew that the racist legal system in the United States, I would receive no justice. I was also afraid that I would be murdered in prison. I later arrived in Cuba, where I am currently living in exile as a political refugee. The New Jersey State Police and other law enforcement officials say they want to see me brought to justice. But I would like to know what they mean by justice. Is torture justice? I was kept in solitary confinement for more than 2 years, mostly in men's prisons. Is that justice? My lawyers were threatened with imprisonment and imprisoned. Is that justice? I was tried by an all-white jury without even the pretext of impartiality and then sentenced to life in prison plus 33 years. Is that justice? Let me emphasize that justice for me is not the issue I am addressing here. It is justice for my people that is at stake. When my people receive justice, I am sure that I will receive it too. I know that Your Holiness will reach your own conclusions, but I feel compelled to present the circumstances surrounding the application of so-called justice in New Jersey. I am not the first or the last person to be victimized by the New Jersey system of justice. The New Jersey State Police are infamous for their racism and brutality. Many legal actions have been filed against them. And just recently, in a class action legal proceeding, the New Jersey State Police were found guilty of having an, quote, officially sanctioned de facto policy of targeting minorities for investigation and arrest, unquote. Although New Jersey's population is more than 78% white, more than 75% of the prison population is made up of blacks and Latinos. 80% of women in New Jersey prisons are women of color. There are 15 people on death row in the state, and 7 of them are black. A 1987 study found that New Jersey prosecutors sought the death penalty in 50% of cases involving a black defendant and a white victim, but only 28% of cases involving a black defendant and a black victim. Unfortunately, the situation in New Jersey is not unique, but reflects the racism that permeates the entire country. The United States has the highest rate of incarceration in the world. There are more than 1.7 million people in U.S. prisons. This number does not include the more than 500,000 people in city and county jails, nor does it include the alarming number of children in juvenile institutions. Most of the people who live on this planet are still not free. I ask only that you continue to work and pray to end oppression and political repression. It is my heartfelt belief that all the people on this earth deserve justice, social justice, political justice, and economic justice. I believe it is the only way we will ever achieve peace and prosperity on this earth. I hope that you enjoy your visit to Cuba. This is not a country that is rich in material wealth, but it is a country that is rich in human wealth, spiritual wealth, and moral wealth. Respectfully yours, Asada Shakur, Havana, Cuba.
Hello, hello. Hi. Oh my gosh. So we're going to go to a music break and then I'm going to let y'all marinate on that Asada Shakur audio, because at the end of the day, Black women are always put in the middle of turmoil and we never really know why, but I think it's because of, you know, the angry Black woman sort of, you know, situation. So I think that this is a good time for us to do a music break. And then after the break, you can pick anything you want. But after the break, I have a special group of people coming in today. We will definitely be chatting more about this situation. And if you are tuning in and you realize, dang, I really don't know what she is talking about, go get some water, come back, and you'll have a seat at the table for a discussion, okay? All right. So this is Evergreen with your host, Rachel Hartley, for Bread and Roses. Thank you so much for tuning in. Talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Panther Party, an organization that was targeted by not hesitated to publicize their request. I am completely uninformed as to the accusations they are making against me. Why, I wonder, do I warrant such attention? What do I represent that is such a threat?
Please. Good evening. You are tuning in again to Evergreen on 90.7 FM. And this is KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Rachel Hartley. That was a clip of Asada Shakur giving her, basically letting us know what was going on with her when it came to her arrest and the hunt that the U.S. government did on her regarding that incident we had mentioned in New Jersey. And so she's still considered enemy number one and is still on the most wanted list in the United States of America. There's speculation that she's in Cuba. There's speculation that she's in Guatemala, things like that. But she's not here. And I want to talk about her in regards to anger and why Black women tend to always be in the middle of turmoil and what that means. And I'm going to read a quote by one of my favorite authors, Maya Angelou, where it states, "Bitterness is like cancer. It eats upon the host, but anger is like fire. It burns it all clean." And we have three guests here on the mic ready to give their take on Asada's clip and what anger means for Black women and what that means when it comes to us always being in the middle of somebody else's stuff. So if you don't mind introducing yourself to the listeners, just state your name and why Asada is important to you.
Sure. So I'll start. Hello, KBOO listeners. My name is Carmen Dennison. And Asada, goodness. Asada is important to me because she is a Black femme representative of the Black Panther Party. She was a brilliant thinker and a powerful voice for Black people's empowerment. And she also is a Black woman who has been in and out of hiding at various points in her life because she has been falsely charged with, I believe, murdering a police officer.
Yes.
I think that was her and a number of other Panthers, which is a conversation we can continue later, too.
Right.
It's the consequences of false allegations. I think that she is in many ways a symbol of criticality and resilience.
Totally.
Hello, my name is Tresha Dakers, and Asada, for me, she's really important, similar to some of the reasons Carmen gave, but I think for the most part, the honor and respect that she gave to her ancestors, and for her, even though people like to liken her as an activist or advocate, I don't think for her it was about work, and that is the situation for a lot of Black women. It is not about work. It's literally our lives.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So, and after reading her biography about a few years ago and like knowing what she had to go through.
Yeah.
I just couldn't leave that space not having respect and love for her. And automatically as a Black woman, that's just a given for me.
Right.
So, yeah.
Hi everyone, this is Lakeisia. Asada is important to me. I very recently just finished her biography and was kind of blown away that I had not heard about her until I had to, you know, search for her, or until I was actually around Black women. Did I hear her name as much as I should have heard it? And so I think just the way her biography was written really reminded me why Black women's voices are so important. For someone like her and the situations that she had to endure, for her to write her poems and her biography and to share that out was so important, almost as important as her actually experiencing those things. And so, yeah, I'm just very inspired by what she went through and her willingness to share and be open and honest and completely raw about it.
Sure.
Nice. Yeah. And I want to go back to what you were saying, Carmen, about false allegations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, my opinion, I think that Black women are always the target for false allegations in something, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, if we react the way that we would like to react, or the way I would want to react as a Black woman, I'm labeled as angry. And then a lot of people, like, in the years past, have been trying to take that term, being, like, angry, into something else like that as our power, mm-hmm, in a way. Mm-hmm. So what do you want to speak on that?
Anger, the reclamation of anger. I mean, I think that that in and of itself is a conversation we can definitely have here.
Yeah.
Because the term, the negative connotations of anger, you know, you can say anti-Blackness and misogyny. Goodness, the angry Black woman label. It's, like, very much,
right.
You know, the very emblematic of those things. And, you know, Black women being the most marginalized members of the society, when we have opinions or when we speak up for ourselves, oftentimes it's met with, you know, a lot of fragility, and it's, mm-hmm, seen as a threat.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in the case of Asada, she had power, right? She had organizing power, and people saw her and heard her. And so she became the target of, you know, various
right
efforts to, right, you know, throw her in prison and,
yeah,
silence her. Mm-hmm. You know, that's, her case is one that is extreme, right?
It's, yeah.
But I think in micro ways, Black women have that experience all the time. It's daily, yeah, occurrence.
Totally. And for on the daily, I mean, like, I y'all can give any sort of rant in a way of how you feel that you experience things like this on the daily. Like, for me, I feel like, you know, as a Black woman, I'm not only, like, watched, but, like, surveillanced. Mm-hmm. I am, you know, seen as a way that is uncomfortable for white people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because Black women, I believe, have immense power and are automatically, when you walk into a room of white people, people automatically look at you and are ready for you to react to something. So how do you feel about that? And in a sense of, like, you know, being falsely accused of something, but why is it that we have to control our emotions for fragility? I mean, like, you, that's a, that was a lot, because I had a lot to get out. But I think that white people are fragile when it comes to Black women's anger.
And I think it's also because it's, like,
yeah,
been suppressed in such a way. Like,
right,
Black women are never heard for, mm-hmm, anything, really. And so
speak more on that. What do you mean by Black women aren't heard?
Oh, so, like, for example, the way Black women are treated in hospitals. Like,
right,
not being, like, our feelings and our emotions have never been considered.
Asada was handcuffed,
right,
while in her hospital bed, while she was interrogated,
right, and threatened
and called the N-word,
yes,
yeah, repeatedly,
right,
exactly,
had guns pointed at her, like, in recovery, you know,
yeah,
right,
and
right,
there are women, even women, as we saw, like Serena Williams, someone of such high caliber who people know, you know,
mm-hmm,
will still get disrespected and still be considered not human.
Right, right.
So when we express these feelings and we're honest and we're open, people can't handle it.
Sure.
Right.
And,
right,
you know, that to your point about hospitals and Serena Williams, for example, their infant mortality rates and, like, deaths, right, of Black women who are giving birth are higher now, I think, in the United States than they were in the 1880s, mm-hmm, something really obscene.
Right.
And so the fact of the matter is that Black women are living under threat of death in so many ways all the time. And so that pressure, the pressure of racism, has physical, psychological, emotional manifestations. So to be able to articulate that experience is a form of healing. Mm-hmm. And so this way of, like, silencing Black women by saying, oh, well, you're angry, it trivializes the pain and the daily pains and microaggressions that Black women experience and just trying to live their lives.
Right. We're also seen as, like, difficult,
mm-hmm,
right,
yeah,
with that anger. And how do you feel about that?
Well, I can speak to that. My most recent work experience, I think it's just classic gaslighting. Mm. So when
for the listeners, what is gaslighting?
I mean, basically putting someone who's victimized in mm-hmm. a position to question their own experience, mm-hmm. to even be in a position where they start to feel like, oh, this is my fault.
Right.
In the most layman way I can say. So I've had experiences where in the workspace, I was disrespected and expressing that or asserting my agency and like defending myself in an effort to like counteract that experience. By the time we got to sit down and talk about it or have like a facilitated dialogue, it was basically the summary was she was like really angry and the person was traumatized by the anger that I displayed. And I just basically said to them, like, regardless of how you're gonna perceive me, mm-hmm. number one, I have the right to be angry right. whenever I want.
Right.
You don't get to dictate or tell me how to feel or how to react right. to a situation where you upset me, regardless of what your intent is. Mm-hmm. To hell with intentions. I'm just about impact. And
right.
so if I'm responding to that, I have the freedom to do that. Mm-hmm. And so I find it like really dismissive or gaslighting when somebody's telling you basically like, she was just so angry and like it's just like a classic way to like just dismiss everything.
Right.
So we don't get to really deal with the issue at hand because
right.
oh, the way you dealt with it mm-hmm. is like just not I guess according to them not okay.
Right.
And I don't
right.
think that should be left up to the person
totally.
Who's in the wrong. So yeah.
I agree. And what you're speaking about is kind of like I just see like someone just like it's this black woman and with all this turmoil going on around her, she's just like dropped into like a tornado mm. of madness.
Mm-hmm.
She's in the middle of it. And then she just gets kicked out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, the simple truth of it though is that black people suffer because white people don't want their feelings hurt.
Mm.
Black people die because of white fragility. And so I think that, like, you know, what you're both describing is you're talking about professional situations in which, you know, you're doing something because you love it, because you care about it, because you want your labor to be the best that it can possibly be. And I think that that's another thing, like a lot of black folks put a lot of pride into their labor, right?
True.
A lot of love. And that means criticality. Criticality is very much an expression of love. If you care deeply about something, you'll see sort of all of the parts of it that are flawed and you'll want to improve it. Addressing these types of things in the workplace oftentimes results in a fragile response
mm-hmm.
or some form of retaliation, which sadly, you know, the consequences of that are invariably suffering, right?
Yeah, totally.
Loss, you know.
Yeah, I think that. I mean, in my opinion, fragility is meant to, you know, continuously make people suffer.
Yeah.
And make black people suffer. Because fragility is just, it's an excuse.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's also kind of a lack of inability to self-reflect. Like, or have a desire to self-reflect and be self-critical. I think that's one of the hardest things for white folks is to just accept, like, this is the history. Inevitably, you are connected to that history. And you have to be able to recognize when you're perpetuating the systems that keep these inequities going. Like, you are a part of this. Like, you don't have a pass out of this conversation.
Right, right.
No one does.
Yeah, this isn't an option for you, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, we tend to be the first or, you know, last one hired, first one fired, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
And so in order to reach a place of, like, you know, financial mobility, financial security, we do. Mm-hmm. I mean, folks like to say, like, I know that the term black tax has become kind of taboo, but we're still paying it, right?
Right?
We're still working. And as black women, we're working four times as hard.
Yes.
And oftentimes that labor goes completely unrecognized.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that or there's not really, you know, with as far as the like criteria for judgment under in the conditions of like sort of white supremacist workspaces or what is valued, you know, what types of labor is valued. Like, I don't, emotional labor goes unseen. Black women's emotional labor is generally, you know, unacknowledged. Black women's intellectual labor is undervalued while also appropriated. So I think that, and then just, you know, the fact that like we're able to do the job at all, you know, our labor is in, it's so easy to undercut our labor or our education.
Exactly. And even Asada was speaking about education as well, right? And like how she was so astonished of how how people were speaking of her just as just inadequate. Mm-hmm. And she knew everything that she knew. Mm-hmm. She knew that she knew she was smarter than a lot of the people who were questioning her or trying to lock her up, you know? Mm-hmm. And even thinking about that, it's heavy because I feel like, I think that there just needs to be like a special day or month for Black women, because I want answers. I want answers from white people.
You won't get them.
Right.
Yeah.
And speak on that. Why won't I get an answer?
You already know why.
Well, why do you think the listeners need to know why I, Rachel, as a Black woman, can't get answers?
Because I don't know. I hate even thinking like this sometimes, but it like feels evolutionary. Like there is... the like white people have not had to for some time like really like evolve their thinking. I mean, just think about the crazy just terrible things that had to be done to get here. You know, like unimaginable things,
right?
And so the fact that we're here right now and they're completely trying to ignore what's happened. I mean, that's because over time, they've just completely blocked out empathy on a level that is unimaginable.
Right.
To do the horrors that they did. Like, and I don't think they have the capacity to recognize how that transfers into the world we're in right now. Like, they don't. They won't.
I mean, even I don't know for, I don't know. I'm not white, so I have no, I can't. But I will say that dismantling white supremacy is something that's critical for all of our survival at this point.
Totally.
White supremacy is capitalism. White supremacy destroys the environment. Yeah. White supremacy is marching the whole of humanity off a cliff when you look at it at a systemic level. So I think that, you know, there is an incentive on everybody's part to critically dismantle white supremacy. Will it happen? I don't know. I what's going on right now in politics, it doesn't look great. And I think that, you know, as an ideology, it is not, it doesn't benefit anyone, right? It's an ideology that's built sadly on, I keep saying sad. It's an ideology.
But
that,
it is sad.
Yeah, it is. It is sad. And yeah. I think that it's
sad for whom?
Well, it's built on Black and brown corpses, right?
Right.
You know, it's built on a lot of death. And so I think that, like, ultimately, I mean, I don't know. Yeah. I think we're all, right now, that is the question, contemporary, in contemporary life. It's like, what is going, what now?
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, if you have an advantage in a system that's always worked for you, and in the last, I'm going to say 600 years, or more, pertaining to white people, we don't need any more examples of like, or their inability to like show up or do the right thing. In any era you can like go back, revisit, they've always let us down. If you are like looking to them to like, I don't know, rescue or like do the right thing and like get us out of a system that, unfortunately, we didn't create the system, but we are tasked because it's based on our survival, or survival depends on it. We're tasked with the duty of upending it, and we didn't start that. So, and even to take it back to Asada, with that advantage in a system, if you have an advantage where Black women, Black people in general are already seen as violent perpetrators, whatever, mm-hmm. you can easily use that to your advantage at any moment to just dismiss anything. It, as Keith was saying, mm-hmm. it removes your need mm-hmm. to be accountable
right.
in any process by just saying, yeah, right. they're just angry and just all the time.
Right.
And easily, people already think of Black people as such and such. Mm-hmm. So it's just like the just to show up in your own self-critique is you don't have to do that when you can just like distract like mm-hmm. with the president quote unquote does that all the time.
Right. Yeah. You know? He doesn't have to hold accountability.
Yeah.
He does not. Never no one has. Holds him accountable.
Yeah. And white people have never had to be accountable for anything that they've done to this day. All they've done is instead have a football game every Thanksgiving. Cowboys versus the Indians, which to me is just like a ritualistic display of like genocide.
Yeah, mm-hmm. totally.
And there's pride in that.
Yeah, and even in the Super Bowl as well, that was recent, you know, which in both games, trafficking of women, particularly Black women, mm-hmm. is the highest. Wow. On that note,
right.
I would totally love to go to a music break because y'all just bring the energy and I'm feeling it. It's a little heavy and I like it. But I gotta breathe.
So also important for self-care for Black women.
Yes.
Black people in general.
Yes. I love the lo-fi hip-hop tunes. That is what keeps me calm in a way. And I thank you for bringing that up because at the end of every evergreen, I try to talk about what are best practices for self-care and mental stability. And keeping yourself healthy and okay. So yeah, definitely. If, after the music break, we'll go back to speaking on this and talking about more so what we want to see as an outcome, if any, to all of this, or if we just want to go ahead and hash out some more of our anger when it comes to talking about anger. So thank y'all so much. This is Evergreen, and I'm your host, Rachel Hartley, for 90.7 KBOO FM. Stay tuned.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO 90.7. This is Evergreen for Bread and Roses, and I'm your host, Rachel Hartley. And I have the lovely opportunity to be joined by Lakeisia, Tresha, and Carmen on the mic to talk about... talking about anger, talking about even we even brought up points of like trauma and why Black women, due to fragility, white fragility, end up in the middle of the tornado of turmoil in situations, right? Whether it be work, hospital, day-to-day, public transit, whatever,
all of it,
right? And at the end of every Evergreen, I try to give y'all listeners points of self-care that I like to practice, and hopefully that you can practice as well. And we'll go around to everyone to talk about what forms of self-care y'all like and why it works for you, why you recommend it, anything like that. So my self-care is always meditation. I try to take a deep breath at least like for 15 minutes every single day, taking deep breath, meditating, and reflecting on what happened during the day, why I think it happened, and what I can do for a better tomorrow. So that's my form of self-care. I usually do that with some music or something instrumental, because sometimes lyrics can like take you in another direction that's not meditative. So that's me.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Nice.
Self-care. You know, I like self-care is something that I'm constantly trying to like, I'm trying to find something that really works.
Mm.
That's okay. You know, I try to and you know, in light of I guess also my closing thoughts on the topic of anger,
yeah,
too, right? Like it's so difficult not to. So yeah. Punch the air, y'all. Also music. I found is really effective. Like I've been listening to a lot of Black femme hip hop artists that are one Baby
yes.
Mother.
Yes.
Baby Mother.
I love Baby Mother.
So much healing. So much healing in Baby Mother. So I guess I was actually listening to her today. So I guess those are my most recent efforts, my most recent self-care efforts.
Nice.
I could go, honestly, self-care is something that I'm still trying to figure out, similar to Carmen, because sometimes, honestly, meditation, I light candles. I've recently started practicing IFA.
Nice.
And it's helpful sometimes, but if you're living in a space like Portland, which I think, based on my experience, because I have lived in other parts of the United States, to traverse a space where from every angle you're being penetrated by whiteness or white supremacy, like depressing doesn't even begin to define the experience that...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
The experience that comes with, and I feel like sometimes sleeping helps, mm-hmm. but you can't sleep too much because then you
sometimes
can end up,
sleeping helps.
It does, because yeah, for once them. You're like you're resting and you're away. It's like literally escaping.
Yeah,
and sometimes right. that's escapism, you know. But like feeling like sometimes liberation for a Black woman equals asylum, and that can be political or not. Yeah. And it's unfortunate. So then it's like, how do we afford liberation in a system where we're always under surveillance, microaggressed, micromanaged?
Mm-hmm.
It's like a plantation. It's just an abstraction of slavery all over again.
Right, right, right.
And for me, sometimes I don't think there is self-care for that until we are removed. And that should be self-determined until we're removed from
right.
this system and not reliant on it.
Correct.
I don't think it's possible.
Huh.
We're just going to cycle. It's just a cycle of abuse that we're going to keep looping into.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so,
mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, self-care for me is like asterisk.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think for me, self-care is like doing the things I've always wanted to do, but that the world kind of tells you that you shouldn't even start, you know? And that's like creative things that we do. Like for me is writing. I really love that. And, you know, drawing, all of that stuff just really kind of refreshes me. Mm-hmm. Because even though there's a lot of like self-esteem things you have to deal with when you're creating and writing, mm-hmm. and you have to like face that as you're doing it because you're being really vulnerable. I think pushing through and being creative and expressing yourself is like a huge, like, you know, way to kind of revolutionize yourself here, mm-hmm. in a way, and not in the weird like revolutionary like term or whatever, right, that people use nowadays because it's like a profitable term. But yeah, just creating is a great way to do that.
Awesome. And before we end, I've got a note from our engineer, our wonderful engineer, from a caller who wanted specifics, or wanted to specify specific white people who have harmed black women. And to that caller, I just want to say thank you for having a seat at the table. You can now get a glass of water. And I think that you need a break, because what we're speaking of is the system that we live in. Every single white person by default is harming every single black person in the United States of America. And that's my answer, and I'm sticking to it. Thank you so much for tuning in to Evergreen for Bread and Roses. We really appreciate y'all so much. I'm your host, Rachel Hartley, and thank you for joining us. Talk to you next Friday. Bye.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Trillium Public Charter School in North Portland. Enrollment for the 2019-2020 school year is now open for students K-12 with an open house on February 21st at 6:30 p.m. More information online at trilliumcharterschool.org.